I was at a birthday party this past week for a friend of ours, and I didn't know barely anybody else other than our friend and his wife at this party. So I was sitting at this table, and I was getting to know some people that had also been invited for the very first time. So we were doing the natural, obligatory, hi, this is my name, and this is what I do. And so I was talking to one lady, and she said, well, I'm staying at home with my kids right now, this season of life, but I play a little bit of violin on the side. And so I was asking her questions about that. What does it mean to play violin on the side? Like, I'm thinking she gets a couple of spare minutes in the basement. She, you know, brings it out and plays a little music, whatever. But it turns out for her what that meant was that she was part of, like, these world-renowned symphonies that play internationally and are recognized all over the world. Like, well, on the side, I just travel the entire world playing the violin. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. So then we went to the next guy, and he said, well, I'm an aerospace engineer by education. But I'm now in the software field, and I am at my company, I am developing virtual reality software. And our company, and I believe that we're going to change the way that everybody is educated, because we're creating systems where people are going to be able to create in the virtual world 3D models of everything, and it's going to change the way people learn and how education works, and the whole world is going to change. And I thought, oh man, that's a big deal. And then there's this other guy there who worked his way up at his company, starting at the bottom rung, became COO, and then sold the company for $1 billion with a B. So then somebody leans over to me and goes, hey, what do you do? And a little piece of me was a little bit insecure, right? Like, I didn't sold anything for $1 billion. I'm not an aerospace engineer. I don't play on world-recognized symphonies, none of that kind of stuff. And so I'm feeling a little insecure. And so I say, I'm a minister. And we were in a restaurant, it was a little bit loud, so I guess I didn't hear. So the lady, she leans in and she goes, what's that? You're in medicine? To which I replied, yes, I'm in medicine. I am the chief of medicine at a very big hospital that all of you have heard of. I'm a really, really big deal. But to be honest with you, I don't know if you've ever, I'm sitting at this circle and I'm going, man, I am a little bit out of my league. I mean, I'm not good enough in this conversation. These people are making tons of money and changing the world and do incredible things. And it was hard not to walk away without that little voice in the back of my mind going, man, what are you doing? What have you accomplished? How much are you making? What's going on with you? And I don't know, have you ever felt that? Like, hey, maybe I'm just not good enough. Maybe there's something wrong with me. I don't stack up well. I don't compare well to the people around you. Actually, there's a whole lot of negative voices that we often have in the back of our minds that play through our lives. And in this series, what I want to talk about is those voices. And I want to talk about some of those messages. I want to identify them, bring them up, make them conscious. Because for a lot of us, they become subconscious. They're just things that we're allowing to play in our mind. And they're really becoming our worldview. A worldview, we could define in a lot of ways, but it's essentially these assumptions that we have about how the world works that inform how we live. They're thoughts that we have, and they're more than thoughts. They're thoughts that we have attached through different experience, intense emotion to, and they've become the foundation from how we live, whether we think about them or not. And they dictate things like how happy we are and what confidence level we are at and what we think of ourselves, our own self-worth. And they dictate things like what are we going to do and what are we not going to do and will we step out and take a risk here or be part of this or not this or that. And we don't even think about them anymore. And so I want to bring some of those things up and talk about them. And today I want to start with this one. Just a little bit of what I felt the other night at that birthday party. Just going around the table, sitting there and hearing all these great things other people would do. It's just this thought that I am not good enough. I'm not good enough. You can actually find all over the place people are writing about this, because in our culture, in our society, this is something that so many of us have come to believe. And so sociologists and psychologists, there's all kinds of studies to talk about where does this come from. Some will talk about the fact that in our childhood, even as kids, we tend to take on certain stresses or failings in our family onto ourselves and start to believe this lie that I'm not good enough. So for some of us, somewhere along the way, maybe your parents split up or divorced, and you thought as a kid, man, if I was just better, if I was just more well-behaved, if I just made life easier on my family, if I had just done the right things, everybody would have been happier. They wouldn't have fought as much. They wouldn't have broke up. Maybe I'm not good enough, and that's why this has happened. for some of us along the way, it's because of disappointments that we haven't lived up to certain standards, standards that other people have for us, that we have for ourselves, ways that we thought we should have performed. Maybe it's in competitions at sports or education or all kinds of stuff where we're disappointed. We thought, I should have done this and I should have won. I should have got ahead and I didn't. For some of us, it's things that people said to us, people that we really thought were influential in our lives. We really cared about their opinion, and they maybe didn't even mean to do it, but they said something to us that just hit us right in our insecurity, and we never forgot it. We just carry that thought around, and it becomes part of our worldview, part of how we think about the world. For some of us, it's rejection, maybe in a relationship or somewhere along the way where we were told we were not welcome, or we were broken up with, or we were kept out of a certain group, and that rejection stings and gave us this message, I'm not good enough. That message has a lot of different forms that it comes into our lives, but I think almost all of us have it. I'm not blank enough. What are you not enough of? I'm not smart enough. I'm not thin enough. I'm not good looking enough. I'm not successful enough. I'm not rich enough. I'm not fun enough. I'm not outgoing enough. I'm not a good enough husband or wife or parent or student or employee or leader or friend. The list could go on and on and on. But a lot of us, part of what's operating in our lives and dictating how we live, what we say, how we think about the world and the people around us, has some of this influence in it. I'm not good enough. And there's another place that perpetuates this. Wherever that idea comes from, we live in a very competitive society. We live in a society where we're always told that we need to get ahead. We need to get ahead of other people. We see ourselves competing with one another. We live in a capitalist culture where one of the fundamental principles is that we need to earn what we get. Life is fair. And you need to earn whatever it is that you want in life. And capitalism has a lot of good aspects to it, and there's a lot of great things that come out of it. But a lot of us, we are living in this culture that has become very competitive. How do we know what we deserve and what we earn? The way that we often figure it out is by competing with each other. And some of us have started to believe that this is a zero-sum game. A zero-sum game means if somebody's winning, somebody else has to be losing. If I'm getting ahead, it means somebody else is falling behind. If I'm falling behind, it means somebody else is getting ahead. And so in our minds, we start to look at other people and start to gauge where we're at in life, how well we're doing, what we're worth, based on how we stack up against other people. Have you ever felt that? This is not the most beautiful, pretty part of human nature. But I'm going to guess that there's a whole bunch of you that are kind of like me that once in a while have that's registered, where you look at somebody else, and if they're struggling a little bit in a certain area of life, a big part of you, a good part of you, empathizes with them, wants them to do better and all that kind of stuff, but there's that little ugly part that we don't like to acknowledge, we don't like to talk about, we don't like to even just know that it's there, that he's a little bit glad that somebody else is struggling. Oh, we don't want them to do horrible, but if I get my grade back, I want you to do well, but just not quite as well as I did. Or you look at somebody else's family and they're going through some troubles in their marriage and you can see the stress and you go, oh, they're my friends. I want them to do really well. I hope they get over it. But you know, we don't struggle with that. Our marriage is pretty good right now. Big one for parents is you look at your kids and you know, somebody else's kids and you start comparing them. And if your kids are a little bit further ahead or doing really well in an area and their kids are struggling and there's this little part of you go, oh, look at my kids. They're doing better. And it's this ugly part of us that's competing, competing, competing because we want to just be a little bit better to remind us, yeah, we are good enough. And the flip side is true. We look at other people, and when they're a bit ahead of us, when we're the ones struggling, when we're the ones whose marriages have hit a struggle, when we're the ones that didn't do great on the exam or the paper, and we didn't get the grade that we want, and we look at other people, and we see they did a little better than us or a lot better than us, and all of a sudden, we think, oh, man, I'm just not good enough. I don't compare well. They're doing better than me, and why are they getting there, and this isn't fair? And we go through the whole gamut of emotions that come with those thoughts, and that has become part of our worldview that's stuck not only in our minds, but in our hearts. And so many of us, for so many of us, it's this idea somewhere along the way of I'm not good enough. And we're living in a world where we're told we have to compete to get ahead, and we're trying to do that. And today, we started this series called Don't Tell Me What to Do. I want to talk about things like that. I want to talk about those voices that are ordering our lives, whether we know it or not, and for us to be able to identify them, bring them up, and say, don't tell me what to do. I'm not living that way anymore. I'm not going to let those lies and those thoughts order my life, order how I think and feel about myself, order how I think and feel about other people and how I treat the people around me. Don't tell me what to do. So in the middle of a very competitive culture that we live in, that always tells us we have to compare well and get ahead, I want you to hear another option, a way that Jesus teaches us that we can live life. If you have a Bible and you want to turn to Matthew chapter 20, I want to read this parable, this story that Jesus tells. Story is such a powerful way of conveying truth in a way that Jesus just illuminates a different way to live, a different way to think that I want to invite you into. Of course, this kind of feeling that we have is not new. This idea that we have to get ahead and we compare each other to ourselves is not new. It's so old. Maybe it's been around forever. There's a book in the Bible called Ecclesiastes. There's a great book, especially if you're kind of skeptical and even cynical a little bit, because the writer of Ecclesiastes can be very cynical and sometimes downright negative. But this is what he says in Ecclesiastes 4 and chapter 4. He says, "Then I observed that most people are motivated to success because they envy their neighbors. But this too is meaningless, like chasing after the wind." He says, I noticed this 3,000 years ago when this was written. I noticed this. Most people are motivated to get ahead because they're jealous and they're envy, and I got to be a little bit better than you. We see it over and over and over, people being competitive. And you know what that's like? He says, like chasing the wind. You never catch it. You're never satisfied. You never arrive. It never feels good. You never finally go, oh, and then I was better than everybody, and now my life is good, and it's all worked out for me. It's meaningless, and it's chasing after the wind. Don't live like that. And then about 1,000 years later, we get this teaching of Jesus, this new way to live. Matthew chapter 20, starting in verse 1. He says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent him into his vineyard. For the kingdom of heaven is like this." This is a way of saying, this is how God operates. Do you want to live the way that the world lives, the way that everybody else lives, the way that culture is? Sometimes maybe you do, sometimes maybe you don't, but let's just think about it. But here is the operating system of God. This is how God is working in the world. You have an opportunity to choose this way if you want to. For the kingdom of heaven, when God gets his way, this is what things look like. "A master of his house went early in the morning to hire laborers for a vineyard." So here's a guy who's wealthy. He owns a vineyard. He's a big deal in that culture. We know that would have been true. He needs to hire day laborers. It's either time to prune or harvest his vineyard. He needs people to work. So he would have gone into the market. At the market, and this still happens in a lot of places in the world, there would have been a spot at one end of the market where men who didn't have a job would have gone and stood, hoping that somebody like this comes along and would give them a day's work. Maybe 2 days' work, maybe a week. Maybe they'd even get a long-term job. But these are people who are unemployed and they need something. They don't want to go home empty-handed to their families, to their wives and children. And so they're standing there hoping that somebody will come. Well, here comes the owner of this vineyard, and he has got work. He takes a bunch of workers and he agrees with the laborers to pay them a denarius a day. A denarius in this culture, this time and place, would have been a good wage for a day's work. So, of course, they agree. This is what we're here for. This is what we want. Come take us. And they go to work first thing in the morning. Verse 3. "And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to them he said, 'You go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you.' So they went." So we come back partway through the morning, and he sees there's a bunch of workers that are still standing there. These are the workers that didn't get hired first thing in the morning. They're getting a little bit more desperate. These guys, too, don't want to go home empty-handed to their families. And so the owner sees them there. He grabs a whole bunch more. "Come on in. You're going to come to work." At this point, they don't negotiate on specifics for pay. He doesn't offer them a certain specific amount. He just says, "I will give you what is right or what is just." They're going to have to trust him a little bit. We're getting a little bit more desperate. So, hey, bring me in. I'll take whatever it is that you're going to pay. "Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, 'Why do you stand here idle all day?' They said to him, 'Because no one has hired us.' He said to them, 'You go into the vineyard too.'" Now, at this point in the story, he's gone to the market 5 times. Just notice that. The owner has gone back 5 times. times. So he goes to the third hour, sixth hour, ninth hour, finally the 11th hour. Now, like I said before, this is something that people still do today in certain cultures and times where they'll stand waiting for a job. But if you go to those places, everybody's gone by noon. If you don't get hired in the morning, and then maybe partway through the morning, somebody's starting work late in the day. By noon o'clock, by 12 o'clock, by noon, you give up. There's no work for me today. Nobody's going to hire me, and it's only part of a day left, and this isn't just going to happen. But we see this master, and he goes back over and over and over until the 11th hour. There's only 1 hour left to work, and he still comes back, and he takes more workers. He said, what are you doing standing here? Why are you not working? Why do you not go home? But they're desperate because they can't go home empty-handed. Think of not just the economic impact, but think of the shame that goes along with it. I couldn't get a job, and I have nothing to come home to, and I got to look my family in the eyes knowing that I didn't bring anything back to provide for them today. And he goes, why are you still standing here? They say, because nobody has hired us. He says, you come to the vineyard too. Come on, work. The day's almost over. There's only an hour. That's okay. You come. And at this point, you see, they don't even talk about pay. There's no mention of it. Not a denarius, not what is right, not what is just. Just come. And these guys come because they are the most desperate. They've been out there all day long. Just note the master for a second. What is he doing? Why does he keep going back? Actually, in this culture, a master, an owner, would never go to the marketplace. He's wealthy. He has people working for him. He would take one of his managers or a steward on his farm, on his vineyard, and he would send him into town to go look for workers if they needed workers. But not here. This master is not aloof. He's not far off. He's coming, and he's coming back over and over and over. Why? If he underestimated the amount of work that he had, this would be ridiculous to miss the mark by that much. Nobody who owned a vineyard would not realize how much work and how many workers they need and have to keep coming back and coming back and coming back. That is absolutely ridiculous. No, he's not coming back because he needs more workers. He's coming back because every time he goes there, they're still there. And he has compassion for them. And he has mercy. He didn't just send a messenger or a manager, but he would go himself because he kept seeing the people there who needed work, the people there whose very worth, self-worth, was tied to whether or not they could work and provide for their family. And every time he saw more people until the 11th hour, and he says, what are you doing still here? Why haven't you given up? Why aren't you working? And nobody will hire us, but the implication here is we can't go home with nothing. And you see this master who says, get in, let's go. Come on, come to my vineyard. Come work for me. Come, and I'll give you a job. Just oozing with compassion. And then there's this great twist in this story. Verse 8 says, and when they came in, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first. Actually, there literally it says, pay them the wage. But bring the last ones first. Now, this is interesting because this is going to be a huge scandal in a second. But if he had called the first ones, the guys who came early in the morning and paid them first, and then they left, and then he pays everybody else, there's no scandal, there's no argument, there's no discussion about this. Nobody's upset. They just go away with whatever they thought they were going to go away with. But Jesus here in this story, beautiful storytelling, is going to make a point. And so they call the ones who are last, the ones who have only been there for an hour, to come first. And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius, an entire day wage. They've only been there for 1 hour. He gives them a whole day's pay. Now, when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us. What a scandal. This is not fair. You can't treat them the way you treat us because we have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. We worked the entire time. We went through the hot part of the day. We've done so much work. We've been more efficient and more productive. But he replied to one of them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to the last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity? So the last will be first, and the first will be last. Oh, I love this. On display for anybody, everybody. The last guy comes and he gets a full day's pay. And then they think, maybe we're getting paid more than we thought, but he pays them all a denarius. And then the guy calls out and he says what so many of us in our culture would say, that's not fair. I earned more. If I compare myself to him, I worked harder, I worked longer, I did more for you, I deserve more, I've earned it. Don't make us equal. Don't treat us equal. That's not fair. I'm getting ahead and he deserves to be behind me. He's only been here an hour. God, you can't do that. And I love the owner coming back and he says, I've given you what we agreed on. This parable is not about the owner underpaying. It's not, he's not cheap. Saying, I'm giving you exactly what you expected. I'm giving you a good wage. I'm giving you everything we agreed upon. And you get to go and do whatever you want to do with it. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but you don't tell me what to do. You can't tell me that I can't be generous. You can't tell me that I can't overpay. You can't tell me that I am not supposed to give him what I've given to you because it's mine and I can be as generous as I want with it and you don't tell me what to do. And so let's line up everybody and pay the last guy first so that the first guy gets the lesson. This isn't fair. The owner's not fair. The owner is better than fair. See, the worth of these workers who were standing at the market waiting for someone to come in this culture would have been directly tied to their work. If I work, I'm worth something. The more that I can work, the more that I can earn, the more that I can bring home to my family speaks to who I am. And this parable is, to be honest with you, it's not about the workers, it's about the owner. Because the owner comes and says, I see your worth. And the first guy's saying, but haven't you seen my work? And he says, I see their worth. I was going back over and over and over, and this guy's saying, I worked so hard for you all day. The owner might have come back and said something like, what do you think I was doing? I was going back to the market over and over and over, and with compassion and mercy, I was bringing more people in, more people who needed to know that I could see their worth, what they're worth, and to bring them in. Don't tell me what to do with my resources. You don't get to tell me whether or not I get to be generous. He might have said to that worker that you came here expecting by the end of the day you would be more rich, but I have expected that at the end of the day I will have become more poor because I see the needs of people and I want to make sure that I give them everything and that they know what they're worth to me. They know that they're loved. They know that they're not alone. It's just this amazing, amazing message. And it hits home to us. Today, for so many of us who are living in a culture of competition, I need to get ahead. I need to get ahead. I need to get ahead. I need to be working the longer hours. I need to get paid more. I need to have a higher lifestyle. I need to look better. I need to achieve everything. And to say, you can live that way if you want, but Jesus announces the kingdom of heaven, the way that God operates, is a different way. And it's based on the incredible, unfathomable generosity of God, who sees our worth and gives us more than we could ever deserve. You know, it's not just in culture where we get these ideas that we're not good enough. There's actually entire theologies about it. There's churches where you go to and just so much emphasis, we're not good enough, we're not good enough, we're not good enough. And there's a sense in which that is true. If we're living in the old system, if we're living in the system that says, I need to earn enough to become worthy, that's the message. You can't live in that system. Of course, you can't be worthy based on your work. But Jesus is teaching something different. He's saying, look at the master. Look at the master. Look at the kingdom of God. Look at how God sees you. He sees you standing in line. And he sees your worth. He says, come on, I'm here for you. I'm going to pay you more than you could ever imagine. It's a new way of living. So, oh, I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. And then God says, I see your worth. You're good enough because I'm telling you you're good enough. Can we allow that voice to be louder than the voice that just tells us over and over you're not good enough unless you measure up, unless you compete well, unless you get ahead of somebody else? That's amazing. The things that we really desire, I mean deep down really desire, cannot be earned in life. To believe that we can be loved unconditionally and experience that we truly belong, the things that we really long for are things that cannot be earned. And yet, do you know what we do? We try and be someone that we're not to try and live up to somebody's conditions. And when we're trying to live up to somebody else's conditions, we're no longer coming after unconditional love. And Jesus paints this picture and says, here's the master who just comes and he sees the need and he says, I see your worth. Come, you can work for me. I'll pay you a whole day's wage. Oh, it's the economy of grace, of real, true love that can't be earned, but is freely given. It's so beautiful. Could you imagine what it would be like for your self-confidence, for your self-worth, for the way that you live and love in your marriage or your relationships, the way that you treat your friends, the way that you interact with the world, if instead of always trying to be good enough, you decide to live in a different operating system. Said, I'm worth something because of the owner who sees worth in me, God who loves me, and to move out. So what does that look like? I started out by saying today that these ideas, like I'm not good enough, are not just beliefs, are not just thoughts, they're beliefs. That we've attached experiential emotion to them. And so they attach themselves way deep down inside of us. Even if we're not thinking about them, we're carrying that around and we're trying to live up to that kind of lifestyle. If we're going to combat that, if we're going to live a different way, we need to enter into a different system. We need to embrace it so that we have those same emotional experiences, but in a different operating system, in the kingdom of God, in the kingdom of generosity of a God who is that loving and caring and beautiful. We need to step into generosity. Stop living out of competition. The truth is that helping others helps you win at life. Helping others win at life helps you win at life. Because we're not in competition. And that's not how relationships work. And it's not how love works. If you really want to get ahead in life, you have to realize it's not about getting ahead of somebody else. It's about bringing them with you. And when you start to help other people in life, when you stop thinking that my life is about making sure that I get ahead, but instead bringing forth other people, that helps you win in life because we only win in life when we win in life. We can't win in life alone because you can't win in love or relationship alone. And the things that are most important, we cannot earn. Life's not a competition. So what would that look like to step into the generosity of God's way? We might say, if we looked at this and said, man, the guy at the 11th hour got paid the same. Well, what's the point in working so hard? What's the point in trying to be more moral? What's the point in doing anything if God's just going to pay us? What does it matter what we do? And the reason it's so important what we do, one of the reasons, is because if we're going to step out of one system, we need to step into another and embrace that worldview. We need to be part of it and experience it. Again, add those emotional experiences to the things that we think so that this becomes our life. We just say, well, it doesn't matter what I do. We're still living under the old assumptions, the old lies. So what would it look like for us to be generous in our lives? First thing we think about is we can be generous with money. And of course we can. We can find people who are in need and make sure that they're provided for. Understand that our lives aren't about how much we can earn and save and spend and have, but to give to other people. But there's so many other aspects of our lives that give us opportunity to be generous. We can be generous with our time. Instead of saying, I'm too busy to help someone else, I'm too busy to listen to someone else, I'm too busy to be there for somebody else, to say, maybe my time is not all about myself. Maybe I can devote some time to the people around me and show them that I really care. We can be generous with our influence. Sometimes there's ways we can help out other people because of connections that we have or because of sway that we have in different areas of our lives. And we can use that not just to promote ourselves, but to promote other people around us. We can do it with our expertise, our skills, things that we're really good at. Some of you students, you're going to be stressed out and you're going to think, school is all about me getting the best grades I can and being better than other people and getting into certain grad programs or getting certain jobs. But what if you took some of your experience and some of your skills, some of your expertise, some of the things you're good at, and when you found people that were falling behind, you said, I can help you get caught up. I can be there for you, not just me. We can do it with our resources. Maybe it's your home or your car, your vehicle, something that you have that could benefit somebody else that you could borrow or lend or give to somebody else to bless them and to do something great in their life. And we can do with our attention. Just to look out and say, man, where in my world are there people standing there, needy, feeling inadequate, and they need someone to come and invite them into the vineyard? To pay attention to them, to give them purpose, to give them meaning, to listen to their struggles, and to make known that they are not alone and that their worth isn't connected to what they do and whether or not they think they're good enough. So who are you going to let tell you what to do? How prevalent are the lies in your mind? I'm not good enough. I'm not blank enough. How much weight do you give that in your world, in your emotional world, in your spiritual world, in your physical world? How much do you let that control the things you do or don't do or how you treat people? Maybe for some of us, it's time to stand up and to hear the voice of God tell us who we are rather than listening to the voices all around us that are telling us that we're not good enough. To that voice, we say, don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me who I am. There's a guy named Henry Nouwen, and he is a theologian. He wrote a number of books on theology, deep stuff. He was educated at some of the best universities in the world, ones that everybody knows about. He had an appointment at one of the most famous universities, one of the most famous schools in the entire world, where he became a professor, and he was teaching, probably thought of by a lot of people as a big deal, someone who had arrived, someone who had achieved, someone who is influential to everybody else. And he gave all that up. And he spent most of his adult life after that creating places and working with adults who had disabilities, severe disabilities, and had to live in these communities where they were cared for. And that's where he did all of his work, devoted his life to. And he wrote this blessing. And just a guy who understood that you could look like you've got it all, that you're doing it all, but that's not always where everything that matters is. And you just give it up to care for and love people generously that were in need. And he wrote this blessing, and it's one that my wife and I have started to recite around our table to our kids, because it's what we want them to know about when they look at the owner, when they look at God, the owner of the vineyard, and know that he is generous and compassionate and mercy, to know that he sees our worth and he loves us and he invites us in, and we don't have to live in that competitive, get ahead kind of way. This is what we want them to know. And so there's a stark contrast for me this week between the table I was sitting at the birthday party, feeling like, man, I don't know if I'm good enough, and the table I sit at with my family, where we recite this. I'm not what I do. I'm not what I have. I'm not what people say about me. I am the beloved of God. It's who I am. No one can take it from me. I don't have to worry. I don't have to hurry. I can trust my friend Jesus and share his love with the world. And as much as we recite that for our kids and hope that those truths about how God feels about them, how God treats them, resound in their hearts and minds as they grow up, I have to admit that as much as it is for them, it's for me and you. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are generous beyond what we could imagine, that you see our worth beyond even our work. God, I pray for any of us who've come in today, maybe under the weight of feeling like we're not good enough, we don't measure up, we don't compare well, we don't compete well, feeling the pressure and the stress of trying to make that work. God, would you show us once again that we don't have to live that way? Those thoughts can't tell us what to do. And God, fix our eyes on the owner, the master of the vineyard, who sees our worth and pays us more than we could ever deserve. It's him who we praise and worship, are forever grateful for. And it's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.